Welcome to the Cotton Specialist Corner podcast. I'm Steve Brown, Extension Cotton Agronomist at Auburn University. And with me are Drs. Brian Paralisi from Mississippi State and Brian Arnell from Oklahoma State. Welcome, guys. I'm glad both of you join us because this is certainly beyond my expertise. But this is a follow-up discussion that we had last year in episode 27, which took place in May of 2023. So the topic is the biological or microbial products in cotton. But let me first ask, are we good with calling them that? Is that the proper label we should attach to these things?
Yes, no. I'm an agronomist. It depends, right? So it really depends on what we're sorting out. The products that we evaluated in the multi-state, yeah, they're biological, they're microbial. But in the world of what we're really looking at, especially in nutrient management, it's much broader than that. In fact, if you look at the crops, the products that are labeled to use in the crop in cotton is much less than others. So, Brian, what do we have? We had six products, maybe?
We had six products in the test.
Six products in cotton. I'll have 9 to 10 that I can run in sorghum, 12 in soy, and up to 20 or 30 in corn. And so the more of those you bring in, you start getting into products. We talk a lot about those that are creating nitrogen-fixing bacteria, those that are creating symbiotic relationships with the plant roots so they can explore more, or those that break down organic matter through decomposition. But there's another spectrum out there that kind of intrigues me as much or more are those that may be able to break down phosphorus. That if somebody been over applying phosphorus for a while, there's more of a chemical reaction, right? It's biological chemical reaction. Or just hormones. I think the conversation of hormones, plant regulators, I mean, in cotton industry, we've been using PGRs for, I don't know, Brian, when did that come out?
Early 80s, maybe, something like that.
And so using a hormone to you know, make the plant do what we want to do, cotton's been doing it the best forever. So there are things, but we didn't look at that in our project.
Yes.
Okay, now, Brian, from Oklahoma State, okay, you do need to bring in your experience outside of this project that Brian Paralisi headed up. We're expecting you to make some contributions wide and broad. So we're looking for you. But so we got a variety of products that do a variety of things, and we're obviously trying to improve somehow, some other way of increasing crop productivity. We all agree with that, right?
Yes.
Yep.
Now, are they impacting, one of today's buzzwords is soil health. Are they affecting soil health in that sense?
Well, I mean, that's another aspect that we're going to look at. Brian A was mentioning earlier. So we created this project, and it's like a buzzword, microbial product, this whatever you want to call it, biological, but there's a real difference there. There's a lot of products out there. And these are the six that we got into the trial. And those, just because they're in there, that doesn't mean they're all exactly the same mode of action or the same possibility to achieve these goals. So, you know, if one were to work, it could have been a bell ringer where another one was at a disadvantage, possibly, because it wasn't. That's not the way it worked. We don't know. But what we do know is we know more than we did last year. And in terms of soil health, one of the things that we talked about at Beltwide, Brian A. was there, is like, so let's say we're colonizing. Is that actually improving soil health? Or are we increasing competition? Are we synergizing? We don't really know exactly what we're doing. But that's what we try to capture this year. And then there's application methods like, you know, chemicals involved in seed treatment, pressure involved with, you know, pressurizing a hose with these things. You know, there's a lot of stuff. We're trying to capture to see what it does once it's spent time in the ground.
I'll tag on a little bit of that with what Paralisi said. So, you know, I'm a straight soil scientist. That's my background in training is nutrient management in soils. And the soil health word for me is a little bit fuzzy because it's more of a overarching theme and not actually quantitative. I want measurable. So if I say soil health, my immediately word, I scratch out the word health and think soil characteristics that are conducive to plant growth. So those are compaction, organic matter, aggregate stability. And so let's go back to that. And how do we improve those things? We either make the plant grow more. So the best thing I could do is get more plant growth above ground and below ground. Immediately, that improves the healthiness of the soil. We know that. So if these products make the plants grow better, then immediately I have better soil health, and use that tag phrase. Mm-hmm. There's discussions about increasing biological diversity. Well, that's more of a theoretical that it's good to be diverse. I don't think the science actually knows if diverse biology in the soil is right. If we look at our native soils, not all are diverse because we got the bugs that are doing what the bugs need to do in that environment, in that condition, and then it shifts as that environment changes. So you've got that. If we do the fungal, if we colonize a big high full growth and we get all these roots, that's like more plant roots. So we could see that as being beneficial for compaction, beneficial for organic matter. We also don't know, is that beneficial long run for the ecosystem, which is what Pierre Lisi was talking about, is that right now, a lot of these things that are deemed to be good, that's more of a theoretical or even philosophical good than it is a quantifiable, we know that this is what we want.
So in simplest terms, Brian Ornell, how would you describe or define soil health to growers? Is it simply a more productive system, soil environment? Is that how you would define it?
My definition of a healthy soil, and not soil health, healthy soil is one that is resilient. So a soil that is less impacted by drought, a soil that's less impacted by flood, and over years can produce more, that production either be above, below ground biomass. Good, healthy soil takes the lows out and potentially increases the top end. And I'll tell you what, a sandy piece of ground in the Delta Mississippi looks completely different than what I need in my high plains that gets 15 inches. What is needed in those soils? Not the same. Or a gumbo, even a gumbo versus a sugar sand probably have different things that are needed to make them more resilient, is a popular word now.
Well, you know, like you said, the difference between my zone, my area, and yours is so extreme. We're just at the tip of the iceberg. There could be a product that works good here, one that works. I mean, it gets big on you quick once you start realizing what you're looking at.
Now, you've already made the point that, at least in Oklahoma, Brian Ornell has looked at, you've looked at corn, soybeans, grain sorghum, and now cotton. And so it does seem that corn, and because it's a 90 million acre crop in the U.S., it's probably gotten more attention. But, and you can branch out and talk in both cotton and corn, both of you. What are the benefits targeted and claimed with some of the biological products that, or again, whatever fits in this arena?
I guess what, for me, what I'm hearing is ultimately we're, most of the aim is for yield goal, but I also think that the aim of this project was to look at how these work by having a reduced nitrogen rate. So a lot of the questions I get and why we designed it this way was like, why would you put such a low nitrogen rate? Well, you know, we'll put a standard rate with this product and you see more on the top end. You know, I can see both sides of it, but ultimately, in order to capture what's going on, I think you need to see it at a reduced rate. You know, sometimes I think that you don't always, or you know, like PGRs, you don't really see a yield. You know, it's a different, is it efficiency? Are you able to maintain and reduce in some other area?
So, Steve, and I'll say it's interesting. I get to interact enough, and this isn't the first time I've seen this. So I'll go back. We've got companies, and Pierre Lisi may have seen this, but depending on what region you're in of the company, maybe it's the Southeast versus the Central region of the company, they both have the same portfolio of products, but they sell the products differently. The exact same product for one group may be sold as a yield stabilizer. In another region, it's a yield increaser. In another region, you can drop, and but it's the same product. So they market it by region. And a lot of these products I've seen national, they change the story not the story. I'm sorry. They changed their marketing directive. Story was probably a just not very fair word, but they changed the marketing directive by the region they're trying to go to, right? And so if we go to my High Plains for the corn stuff and the cotton stuff, it's maintain yield and drop inputs. Well, those folks, we got corn, that 300 bushel corn, they're applying 300 pounds of N, but they also don't leach. So they probably only need 150 pounds of N. There's another way you can market that, but they're dropping in. And then I've seen in, let's say, Southern Missouri, not quite Boot Hill, but that Southern Missouri branch, they're talking about yield stability when you have a lot of rainfall and denitrification, right? And so there's been a concerted effort to market properly or regionally specific. So that's when you ask, what are they saying? It depends on who you're asking, even within the same company.
Now, some of the products, again, from my limited exposure, which I admit is minimal, some of the products have been claiming, and y'all kind of alluded to that, and maybe this particular Beltwide Cotton Incorporated project really gets at this specifically, but some of these products may replace the need for, say, 40 units of nitrogen. Mm-hmm. Is that a pretty standard claim, or is that specific for certain products?
A unit, so anywhere between 20 and 40 pounds of N, depending on the product, is especially I'm looking at the ones that we had in this test. That's a fairly standard on anything that's saying it's either bringing up nutrients or creating nitrogen, 20 to 40 units, which I've always had a little bit of a challenge with, is that they're saying across environment and regions that the biology is going to react the same and give you 30 pounds of nitrogen. When even if we look at soybean rhizobia, we don't expect the same amount of nitrogen from the same inoculant just because of environmental differences.
Let me ask you this. In Oklahoma, what is your standard rate of nitrogen on cotton?
Probably about 60 pounds too much, running 40 pounds, 40 to 50 pounds per bale yield goal.
Okay. I would question, and maybe you have done the studies, and I'm just talking. It's easy to talk and not be accurate, but it would be probably difficult to separate in a trial the difference between X rate and minus 20 or minus 30. Maybe minus 40, you begin to see some separation. What is your experience in that realm?
Just getting a nitrogen response above zero in cotton ground is hard as anything. We pulled perlysium might have seen it. I was looking at some of my deep soils, and I've got ground I haven't fertilized in 3 years, still pulled 200 pounds of N down to 3 foot. I know darn well that cotton's reaching down. Well, our check plot, so one of my best locations that did have a nitrogen response, the zero still cut 4 bale, deep sand, and I bet that taproot just sucked all the way down to middle earth and pulled everything it needed to.
Okay. Now, if you did the same study on corn, would you tease out a difference in were your N rates going much higher? And we're going to come to Mississippi and hear the same response in a minute.
Yeah. Brian's- well, and it goes back. If I'm on farmer field, I've usually been able to pull on farmer field. My first 2 or 3 years of working with a corn farmer, I can draw them back 100 pounds flat on their traditional N rates just because they've been over fertilizing. So, again, getting an N response in corn, I usually have to go to a place 3 or 4 years without nitrogen to get a nitrogen response in a corn crop.
All right. Now, that I've done some of the same, not on corn, but on cotton. And I thought, you know, 1 year, the rate could be much lower. But I really question if I went to year 2 or 3, I would not think the same minimal rate would hold. Talk about that. Is that, you think that's true or false?
Now I'm soil science geeking out, right? So I'm sorry, Paralisi, but we got to think about what we're talking about in nitrogen. Is that a cotton crop needs X pounds of N to create X pounds of lint. We're good with that, right? We also know that we might be in 2% organic matter. In our country, 2% is pretty good. Paralisi, probably about the same. You guys and all, probably 2% is not bad ground for us. The problem is that up in the Corn Belt, that they have pretty consistent freeze. They have pretty consistent unthaw, and that organic matter cycle is fairly consistent on what's released. Down in anything down below in our country, what we consider the Cotton Belt, is that 2 weeks of dry or 2 weeks of wet are going to impact the nitrogen cycle in such a way that it can swing a positive or negative 40 pounds. Well, what does that mean in cotton yield? If you add or remove 40 pounds, how does that influence? So our up and down of the need is more environment driven than nutrient driven. So yes, I can draw down a piece of ground where I get a more consistent, beautiful end response curve. But the demand year to year, I can grow 4 bale cotton every single year on the same piece of ground. Year one, I need 100 pounds. Year two, I need 20 pounds. Year three, I need 250, 300. And then year four, I need 30. And it's just such a environmentally regulated thing. And unfortunately, it's driven by rain and temp, which is not something we could predict past 12 hours, it seems like.
Okay, talk about Mississippi, Brian Paralisi. Your nitrogen rates are pretty aggressive, I think, right?
Yeah, so we're going to be 50 to 70 pounds per bale, and that's going to be dictated by CEC is kind of how we have our model. So, you know, as your CEC increases, we're going to be 70 pounds per bale, and your coarser soils will be about 50. You know, and then if you're kind of moderately. So what that equates to is, we're going to recommend 120 to 140 pounds per acre. Can we get away with less? Yeah, we can. You can make a crop with less. We have a hard time separating, you know, lint yield above whenever you plant, apply 80 pounds of nitrogen or more. I mean, that's usually, well, since we've been doing this nitrogen refinement, we can pretty much get a response or see a separation at 40 pounds. But that goes back to, I think what Arnell was saying, environment, water, temperature, but I think it's magnified here. We have so many more mechanisms for loss. We're a little bit warmer. We can get a little bit wetter. When we get dry, we get really dry, and there's not a whole lot of nitrogen moving. But we, in some way, you can almost say you apply more as a safety net. You can increase that efficiency by reducing rates and splitting applications, but you know, some operations that just isn't feasible. So we're going to be a little more aggressive. I think we're not going to maintain the levels as you do up north of nitrogen, but we have seen through this nitrogen refinement that we do have nitrogen deeper in the soil. But then again, it goes back to a lot of times we dry out, we get compaction issues in our cotton soils, and our roots aren't able to get to it. And then there's just a lot of different things, but by and large, we're going to apply a little bit more, but under ideal conditions, we can get by with less.
So are your recommendations in Mississippi and in Oklahoma, are you targeting or suggesting that growers adjust their rate specifically according to their yield goals?
I don't like to tie nitrogen to a yield goal. I don't think nitrogen is the limiting factor whenever you're looking at upper end yield goals. I think it's either going to be pH or potassium or crop rotation or compaction or moisture. More than anything, I get questions, hey, what if I cut my nitrogen rate? Can I still maintain yield? And I'm like, well, you're going to have to be on top of that, because if it was a perfect year, perfect scenario, and you split your applications and made sure that you spoon fed a little during peak demand prior to bloom, you had everything you need, adequate moisture, you know, your soil is fully charged. Yeah, if your efficiency is up, you can get away with a lot. If you wanted to have a supply there by applying more, then you don't really have to worry about it necessarily, unless you got denitrification conditions. We do, 2021, for instance, we had tremendous leaching denitrification because we had the flooding event. But at that time, you need to be prepared to make an application of something, you know, to try to mitigate those losses. But by and large, you know, it's depending upon what your goal is. Are you trying to, I'm just going to put this out here and know I have enough, or am I trying to, increase profitability by saving a little bit of money here? But if I do that, you know, I can hedge my losses by splitting applications and increasing efficiency.
We do use yield in Oklahoma, partially due to the variability. So in the same county that I work a lot of cotton, I've got dry land is half a bale yield goal. Poor water quality is 2.5 to 3. Good water is 5.
5 bales?
Oh, yeah.
Are you legitimately making 5 bale cotton?
Absolutely.
Great.
We did last year in the High Plains, both High Plains and the Southwest. Wow. Under good water, you pick the right genetics. And yeah, our high plains, if we get in the high plains, it's a kind of roll the dice that every year the different genetics right because of when it gets warm and when it gets cold and locks down. But if you roll your dice right, averaging out 5 to 5 1/4 bell an acre on a center pivot, a section pivot is doable on a pretty regular.
I have a question, Arnell.
Yeah.
So if you have a yield goal based, you know, from half a bell to up to 5 bells, yeah. What's your range of fertility there?
It's 50 pounds per bell on the nitrogen. We don't change P and K yet. We're looking at some of the P and K management, but right now most is based off of sufficiency.
Okay. Well, we run into in excess of nitrogen, and I don't know where we're missing the boat on the yield potential, but if you applied 50 pounds per bale up to 5 bales, we'd never defoliate it.
Well, so the craziest thing is that 5 bale is usually on 50 pounds up in the high plains. It's a corn cotton rotation. You follow your corn crop with cotton and you don't do anything until pinhead squared, and you give it a shot about 50 to 100 pounds, depending on how it looks. Down in the Southwest, even the 5 bale guys. So what we see is the 5 bale guys are going to not do 50 pounds per bale. They're going to draw it down. It seems opposite of what we say, but you can get away with more. And these are also environments, Brian, that were Southwest is hot and dry. I don't hardly use picks at all. In fact, you saw my pictures at Belt Ride, right? Mm-hmm. That little bumblebee cotton was my 5 1/4 bell cotton. I could walk down a 30-inch row space and not hit bowls on either side. And it was just, you know, 36 inches tall, just plants that were nothing but a big bowl. And so we don't need, in our hotter, more arid, higher elevation climates, we don't have the humidity that drives that vegetative move. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, I may have gotten us off track.
Slightly.
We've talked about nitrogen, and it shows us that, hey, it's a lot more variable. Nitrogen is a slippery thing to grab hold of. But, all right, when we speak about these biological hormonal products, we should be thinking more than just nitrogen and the impact there. Would you all agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, well, let's turn the page in, because Brian Paralisi, you've been in charge of this Cotton Beltwide project. And so kind of lay that out for us and describe the treatments and so forth. And I know there have been a lot of people involved as well. So,
okay. Yeah. So it ultimately stretches from Virginia to Arizona. Not every state in the belt has a location. A couple have multiple. Arnell, you have multiple. There's two in Mississippi, a couple in Texas. And so the idea was to try to look at this best we could across as many environments as we could. We originally started with 20 locations. I think West Texas last year, we all know about the drought. A couple of those just failed just due to the moisture. But at the end of the year, we had 17, you know, data from 17 locations where it was 11 treatment tests replicated 4 times. So the first 5 treatments where it was a nitrogen uptake, a nitrogen curve. So we had 0 nitrogen applied and then in 40 pound increments. So 0, 40, 80, 120, 160. And then the remaining 6 were 40 pounds of nitrogen with a microbial product used at its labeled use rate. One was a powdered talc on the seed. One was a foliar applied at pinhead, and then it could have been in furrow, but they, if possible, they wanted it foliar. And then the other 4 were in furrow, or you could do it, you know, 2x2 on the soil. So that's how it was set up. So the data we collected, you know, typical stand counts. We did a tissue sample at cutout, and then which Arnell headed up, and we looked at a full panel of nutrient uptake, and then lint yield and fiber quality.
So you give us a broad overview of the summary of results.
Over 17 locations, year one, preliminary data. It showed all 6 microbial products had the same letter grouping as 40 pound nitrogen rate. There were some numerical differences at alpha level of 0.05. And there was a trend, you know, there was a somewhat of a linear trend, but either way, it was a, all those were a B. All right. And the other thing I like to point out, which showed me that some of this was working, was when we looked at our gen turnout or lint per means, however you want to say it, it had the inverse effect. So like, you know, our gen turnout was the lowest on the highest yielding varieties, or the highest nitrogen rate, because, you know, more nitrogen had partitioned to the seed. And then, you know, the zero nitrogen and 40 were, you know, had the highest turnout. So we could see the effects of the nitrogen on both sides.
I would imagine, let me say, I would assume that you had some variations by location on which was the most appropriate rate, or where yields peaked, or.
Yeah.
That's the broad picture on 17 locations. I realize that's a challenge to represent in a discussion, but
yeah. So, like, I mean, you could break that down on a look. I mean, location definitely significant. You know, very significant. But again, you know, I don't have the slide deck in front of me to look at every single location and how they all interacted. I can speak for Mississippi. We saw the same thing across both locations. There was no difference between. There wasn't a separation between nitrogen or microbial products in Mississippi across both locations.
You mean you had the same yield statistically from zero to 160?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
And one of those, well, if I broke the Starkville location out, there was a difference, but there was such a strong, when you looked at both, we had a location in Raymond, Mississippi, which is like, you know, central. It's in the Hills region. It was the first year in cotton in 4 or 5 years. And obviously, it was a pretty strong presence there in terms of. So there, you know, you can't, that kind of muddies the water, you know, in that location.
What kind of results did you see on yield performance? And we'll come back to the other data in a moment. But Brian Arnell, talk about your yield trials in Oklahoma.
I did pull that out so that I wouldn't forget. So I'll put it this way. So I had two locations. I had one, which is the deep sand peanut cotton country rotation for us. And the other is the high plains. At both locations, the check, the non-applied, was 4.25 bell. So if we know it, if you say anything, my Fort Cobb, my deep sand topped out at 5.25. So between zero and 80 pounds, I gained a bell. Right. Wow. So there's a little separation, kind of separated out between 0 and 40, and almost between 40 and 80, but 80 maxed it. At my high plains, that first step of 40 pounds gained me almost a bell and a half and got me up to 5.4 bell per acre. And so we look at that, and kind of what Brian said is, if we're not getting a response to nitrogen, you know, all that we can then look at for some of these products that say they're nitrogen is there maybe a health, you know, could we? And so go, Brian said that some of these companies want us to apply full rate plus a product or really near. If you look at the data, that 40 pound isn't far from optimum at, I would say, 17 site years. I would say probably at least 10 or 12 of them. It wasn't far from optimum. Pierre Lacy, is that?
Yeah, that's what that implies. And
yeah.
And there have been some belt-wide studies in the past where, the, you know, maybe half of the sites, they did just what you said. They failed to see a response to nitrogen. So, not again, you're pointing out to me how slippery this the nitrogen subject is. But
I want to throw out something else because I've got the slides in front of me, Pierre Lacy, is that we did have somebody on the project that was probably somewhat uncommon for the cotton specialist group. I mean, they got a soil scientist in me, which is already uncommon, but they had Tom Ducey with USDAS out of South Carolina. And Tom's stuff, I think, Brian, for me, was some of the most interesting, where Pierre Lacy, when the products came in, sent them to Tom, and Tom basically checked to see, is what's in them what they're advertising? And we won't get into the nuts and bolts of it, but for the most part, it was as advertised. But I would say there was one or two that Tom left scratching his head, or at least with the question mark on how close to advertisement is what at least he received at his lab. I would just say it's one of those things as we look at this, is that there's a bunch of products on the marketplace and we don't have it. Nobody is doing stringent control. And so we got to remember that, like, you could take a fertilizer to your local Department of Ag and check to see if it is what it says it is. And if it's not, you can get whoever sold it to you for not reaching guaranteed minimum analysis. We don't quite yet have that in this realm because these aren't applied as a fertilizer. So they don't have to guarantee minimum analysis. It's an additive or something else.
Okay, y'all collected a bunch of other data, tissue samples and probably soil samples. Anything y'all want to share from that massive amount of data?
In terms of the tissue, I think, Brian, you might be a little better.
Yeah. So I was just calculating this. In my statistical analysis, I ran over 2,040 contrast statements. I looked at it a little bit differently. There was 798 pages of SAS output. Looking at just the tissue, and I shared the table with you guys. The table's fairly empty as far as meaningful or differences. And I went to an alpha 0.1, Brian, just to, you know, maybe I could create some more. The things that jumped out, it's like we had 1, 2, 3, 4 treatments across 2,040 contrast statements. We had 4 treatments that had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So we had 6 positives out of 2,040 comparisons, which is not a large number, I would say. One thing that did pop out is that the difference between 40 and 80, it didn't show up that often, right? We picked up a lot the difference between 40 and 120, 40 and 160. But that 40 and 80, at least in tissue, didn't really show up very often. So I've always been a little bit iffy as far as tissue analysis. You know, we're not picking up that 40-pound rate. And so I can't say, if I can't pick up the difference between 40 and 80, should I expect to pick up the difference between 40 and a product that gives me 20? Which goes back to me being, you know, little iffy as far as tissue testing goes.
Other data that you collected that may or may not have the results finalized yet?
I don't have all the fiber quality. There could be some differences there. I don't know. It may or may not, but it'll be interesting to see. It's a good component because, you know, quality is worth, at the end of the day, there's some value to it if there's some differences.
Yeah, I've done a lot of quality studies, and I'll say, but not in the fertility realm, but it's been very infrequent that I would tease out fiber quality differences, but the nutrient arena may actually do that, but I'd be interested to see what comes out at the end.
Well, so, with nitrogen being such a driver around seed, it could. I'm like you, I rarely see differences.
So I assume the product will continue in 2024. Is that correct?
Yes.
Any new twist to it or other thing?
We're keeping it the same. To my knowledge, I'm waiting on 2 products to come in, and I've got shipping confirmations. I have not received it yet. And I know Texas is waiting on it right now. I'm trying to get it to them as fast as I can. And actually, you know, side note, it's funny we're having this podcast today, but I planted some of the first cotton in Mississippi today. So
on April 5th.
Yeah.
We
have another project that's a cool germ, you know, the cool germ test.
Yes.
And reading the protocol, our conditions are perfect for it. Try to capture the first one. So,
well, even in Auburn here tomorrow morning, they're calling for 39, and it was in the low 40s this morning and windy. And so you're going to chill that cotton if it can be done. So, all right, let's talk about this. To date, I guess I was going to ask the question, have we seen significant, meaningful breakthroughs that can advance yield or reduce inputs? And I'm hearing, well, not really at this point. How would y'all answer that question?
I think we're going down this route for a reason. There's so much science gearing us towards sustainability, and we know we've got to do something. Do I think that this project is probably going to make this gigantic breakthrough? I don't think so, but it could be, you know, the whole thing standing on the shoulders of giants. I mean, you got to go down that route in some way. I think the sky's the limit. I mean, you don't know until you know, but you've something, and you've got to muddy around to try to figure out where to start. I wouldn't doubt the possibilities of anything, you know, but I just don't know that I think this is going to be just some of the very beginnings of what we can work together from the university standpoint.
I agree. I mean, right now, this is a bit of a numbers game, right? And so 10 years ago, when these products came across my desk, it was mom and pop. There wasn't a lot of R&D money. There was not a lot of products or investigation or standardization. And now we're talking billions of dollars going in, a lot more intelligent people, at least on the side of genetics and this stuff than I could ever imagine. And so if you just look at going to Vegas and putting numbers on a line, the probability is good that something's going to pan out, is how I see it, right? I don't know what it looks like or when, but just the effort and the directions, and it's not just one lane, is that we've got a super highway of, you know, left turns, right turns, and all this stuff where people are going. So I feel like that the probability is that something's really going to start hitting. Now, it might be more regional than not, but our chances are better of finding something, I think, at some point than not.
All right, let me throw up another buzzword, and I don't know if it ties in with this, but I received, actually, it's my brother-in-law. He comes to my house for some reason, a Costco magazine each month. And this past issue had a feature called Inside Costco, and it was with a focus on sustainability. I don't know if y'all might have seen it, but the article was entitled Renewing Our Soil, Regenerative Agriculture Offers an Option for Better Soil Health. And then it states that the goal is to enhance soil health and increase its capacity to store carbon, manage water, and restore ecosystem health, broad term. And I don't know how y'all would define regenerative agriculture. And do you see this subject that we're trying to tackle today is connected with regenerative agriculture?
I would say so. I think that's basically what me and Arnell just said, but it's like thought out and presented in a really pretty way and with simpler words. And then you still hadn't found the answer. I mean, you can say it all day long, however many ways you want. But if somebody could say, this is the picture perfect soil and you can just do this and get it, then that's my take on it.
Regenerative ag, I'm a soil scientist. From day one, I'm trained in Oklahoma, which is meaning we got to keep our soil in place. That is probably fairly important because the last time back in the 30s, we lost a significant amount. And so soil conservation has been the forefront of my brain, and conservation is keeping soil in place. And so, you know, my entire career has been trying to make it so people can make their soil last longer and use less, which is everything regenerative ag is, except not sexy words, as far as I understand, or practices. But for me, our goal is to be able to have our great-great-grandchildren farming this ground in a way that produces good, safe food. So I don't care what you call it. Do whatever words you need. But we are, as agricultural universities, that is our goal, is to do that. And that's why I keep reminding people, whether you want to call it regen ag or soil health or what bit, there's not one of us that's an extension specialist or an agronomist that isn't the goal to do something in a sustainable way. And regen for me, I mean, I've been doing the soil side since the early 2000s. About every 10 years, we get a new buzzword. And then so I expect regen will be out in about 6 years and marketing will need something else. But it's all the same goal. And so it is what it is.
I like how you said that, because I sometimes shake my head because somebody out there discovers this, that we need to be doing, and this is going to save us, this is going to sustain us, this is going to regenerate us. And I like how you said that. So clearly we're about applying science for productivity and present and future. So any other comments we should make today before we close out? Any other rabbits you want to chase or puppets you want to beat with a stick?
I'll have one thing, that today's technology is such that the farmer can be as good or better researcher than us, but do it right. There's a lot of opportunity for on-farm strip trials. Call your local extension office. Call somebody that knows how to do it right, because there's a lot of strip trials that can lead you down the wrong pathway. There's a lot of comparisons that aren't. So I love when a farmer calls me and says, hey, I want to do a strip trial with this. How do I truly do it right? And can't get better information than doing a strip trial right. And you learn a lot.
I would agree. I'm glad you said that, Brian. Because we do strip trials all the time on growers, and I've seen a bunch of flyers of other strip trials that always look really favorable. And I'm not saying that that's not true, but I think it's a good platform to say, you know, we're open. We reach out to your local extension, and if that's something you're interested in, and we'd be glad to do that. Arnell and Steve, what are y'all's cotton acres looking like this year? Increase, decrease, stable?
We thought back in the fall, we thought we'd see a significant decrease. And then as we've done meetings in the winter, we thought, well, we're going to be about the same to a little up. And the USDA prospective planting that came out a little over a week ago said we were going to be up 13%. Corn is not that attractive for us. Cotton is a crop, particularly the northern part of our state, made a spectacular crop last year. The southern regions were punished, but a great crop in the north and no great alternatives. Again, we'll probably see a bump. We're going to see probably 10%, maybe 15% up.
I'm going to guess fairly stable. We're in the folks that stayed the last couple of years in the cotton crop are now into a rotation that they like. So we do, except for our Southwest district, we don't do a lot of cotton on cotton. And so they're in a rotation that cotton makes sense, right? And so when you have that good rotation, you don't just opt out just because the rotation's there for a reason. There's a weed, yeah. There's a bug, there's something that you're taking advantage of.
In the USDA report, we're projected to be up from last year, which we were down significantly. We're going to bounce back to where we were, which is up about 28%. So around 500,000 acres.
Wow, strong numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for joining us for this session of the Cotton Specialist Corner Podcast. We appreciate Cotton Incorporated and their sponsorship and promotion of this effort. And I do appreciate the insights of Brian Paralisi and Brian Arnell in this great area that we look to the future, and maybe we'll see some great innovations that come forthcoming. So thanks, guys. Thanks for your participation.